Now, as we continue in the 11th verse, have not I held my peace even of old, and thou fearest me not? This seems to mean that God had remained relatively silent. He hadn't brought about a stern rebuke. He had not chastised them for a long time. He had allowed them to go their way. And thou fearest me not. This didn't seem to work. It didn't get the job done. They still didn't fear him. And the implication, it seems to me, is that holding my peace didn't help anything. That didn't cause you to bring about a sense of fear or reverence or respect for me. So now, maybe I'll do something else. I will not hold my peace, and see if this then will bring you to a state of having some recognition and fear and respect for me. Verse 12. I will declare thy righteousness and thy works, for they shall not profit thee. Now, whenever I am summing up and giving an account of things, I'm going to declare your righteousness, and I'm going to declare your works, for they shall not profit thee. All of these things that you have done, they will be of no profit. All of the going out into the groves, and there setting up the idols and the temples and the altars, the sacrificing of your children, the making your place out there in the valley of Jehoshaphat rather than in where I want you to worship, all of these things will not profit you. There's going to be no profit. And this to me is a kind of a reference even to the judgment day. When it comes down to the judgment day and every man stands before this bar of God and he has to give an account for the deeds done in his body and he declares their righteousness and their works, he says they shall not profit thee. There are not going to be any pluses in their favor. It's going to all be a minus. And this is a very serious and sober thought for us even today as we think about the fact that we too are going to have our righteousness declared, and we're going to have our works declared, and we wonder, will they be the type of things that will profit us, or will they be things that will bring about no profit? These idolatrous ways, he says, they shall not profit thee. Verse 13, when thou criest, let the companies deliver thee. Now, whenever they're in need of something, when they started crying and needing something, why, let thy companies deliver thee. Let these that you've been associating with, let them be the one who deliver you. And that's another very serious thought for us today. Whenever we need something and we cry to God for something, what if God says, well, you let the ones that you've been associating with, you let the ones that you've been spending all your time with, those that you've been using for your amusement and pastime, you let them rescue you. You let them deliver you. Wow. These idolatrous gods could do nothing. He says, but the wind shall carry them all away. Well, they were just something there that had not even enough strength to keep the wind from carrying them away. They couldn't do anything. Vanity shall take them. But he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. Now, he makes a contrast here. Those that are following after idolatry, why, they have no security. Their company can't deliver them. The wind's going to carry them away. Vanity shall take them. And when something is spoken of as vanity, it's worthless. It's useless. It is of no value. And the things that are of no value shall take them. But he says, he that putteth his trust in me. Now here's the key right here. He that putteth his trust in me, not in idols, not in the other kings, not in making alliances with other nations, not in the works of your own hands, or the life that you get of your hand. He that putteth his trust in me, he says, shall possess the land. And when he's talking about the land, he's talking about the habitation of his people. Back during this time, it was Judea and Jerusalem and the temple. During the Christian age, it is talking about the temple of God, which is the church and the kingdom of God. Shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. Literally, physically, the holy mountain was the area of Jerusalem that included the worship of God. Spiritually and figuratively, the Holy Mountain includes the habitation of God's people. And that's another whole subject as far as a teaching lesson on that. But he shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain, and shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. Now this phrase, cast ye up, prepare the way, is probably a phrase that comes from the fact that some of these roads, and particularly some of them entering into Jerusalem, were so stony that in order for a person to travel the road, the rocks had to be removed out of the way. And some of the riders who've been over there say that you could not ride an animal along the road because it was so rocky. And so when a high potentate would come to visit, then many people would go out and throw the rocks out of the road so that he would have a smooth way to travel. And that's probably an allusion to that or something like that whenever this person who trusts in God, he says, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. That is, he is engaged in the activity of removing the stones or the stumbling blocks from the way of God's people. He doesn't want to make it hard for people to come to God or to know God. He doesn't try to drive them away. He doesn't try to put up a false doctrine, but he rather smooths the way and rather prepares a way that will make it easy and feasible for them to actually worship the true and living God. Now, beginning with verse 15, the thought is that of consolation and assurance. Assurance of pardon to those who would trust God. This is verses 15 through 20. Verse 15, for thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. Now this is God talking. He's the high and lofty one. He's the one that inhabiteth eternity. What a wonderful phrase that is, to inhabit eternity. You know, if we come here and live in this life for 70 years and then we are gone and nothing more ever heard of us, we certainly can't be said to inhabit eternity. And the things that man can see, he can truly see that they are temporary and they do not inhabit eternity. But we're talking about the one now who says he inhabits eternity. He lives in eternity. He takes up eternity as his habitation. Whose name is holy. That is, his name is high. It is associated only with those things that are good and right and pure and according to truth. He says, I dwell in the high and holy place. We know this is heaven. God dwells in heaven. It's called the high and holy place. But he also says, with him also, that is of a contrite and humble spirit. So God, not only then does he inhabit eternity, not only does he dwell in heaven, but he also dwells with him that is of a contrite and humble spirit. Now there are some doctrines, the Gnostics for example, who hold that God is so high and so far removed away from earth that he has very little to do with any of the affairs of earth. And so man just has to kind of muddle himself along the best that he can without any help from God because God is too high to be bothered with the things of man. But that's not what he says here. He says, I not only dwell in the high and holy place, but also I dwell with him that is of a contrite and humble spirit. Now the word contrite means something that is broken, crushed, beaten, or trodden down. So to have a contrite spirit then would be a spirit that is fully humbled, that is fully dependent upon God. Not one that is haughty, not one that is self-sustaining, not one that says that it has need of nothing. But this is a spirit who says, I hunger and I thirst. This is a spirit that is like the description that Jesus gave in Matthew 5, and 3 when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit. This is the spirit that realizes that it has need of something. Those who are rich in spirit, they say, we don't need anything. We have all that we need. But those poor in spirit, they realize they have a need and they seek to have that need satisfied. And so here it is. He is with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit. Now what does he do with that contrite and humble spirit? To revive the spirit of the humble. That the word revive means to give life to or to renew life. He gives life to the spirit of the humble. Now, if you're humble, God is with you. God will give you life. Also, to revive the heart of the contrite ones. To revive the heart, or that is to give them a reason for living. To give them hope. To give them gratification. This is what God does. So he doesn't just stay in his high and lofty place and have no thought about the desires of man. But if you have a contrite and humble spirit, he's going to dwell with you, and he's going to revive the spirit of the humble, and he's going to revive the heart of the contrite ones. Verse 16, for I will not contend forever, neither will I always be wroth. Now, this is probably talking to God's people. When God's people turn away from him, whenever they go into unfaithful practices, when they cause God to be ashamed of them, then God begins to contend with them. And God has an anger. He becomes wroth. And he institutes a chastisement. But he says, I will not contend forever, neither will I always be wroth. That is, he won't always be angry. And he gives a reason for this. For the spirit should fail before me, and the souls which I have made. The reason that he won't always be wroth is that man could not stand it. The spirit would fail before him. Man would suffer utter defeat if God were always wroth with him. And I think what this really teaches us is that whenever God brings about chastisement to us, that he only chastens us with the amount that we're able to bear. He only gives us enough to cause us to turn from our sin and to have us come out of it better than we went in. So when we're going through a chastisement that God has given us and we're truly God-loving people, God is not going to cause it to bring about our destruction, but it's going to bring about our betterment. And he says this, for the spirit would fail before me. If we're contending with God continually, we're going to lose the battle because our spirit will fail before him. And when he is correcting his people, he's not attempting to bring about their downfall, but what he's trying to do is to cause them to come out better than they went in. In Psalm 78, verses 38 and 39, this very idea is reflected. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not. Yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passeth away and cometh not again. Now God, that's his attitude about us. He remembers that we're just flesh. We're just like a wind that passeth away and cometh not again. And so he deals with us in very delicate ways sometimes, so as not to bring about our demise. He's full of compassion, and he forgives our iniquity, and he destroys us not. And I like this phrase, yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath. We think sometimes that God fights against us and we win out. Well, God doesn't use all of his wrath. He turns his anger away sometimes just so he can spare us. For if he used it all, he then would cause us the spirit to fail before him. Verse 17, for the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth and smote him. Now that's the reason that God brought about this punishment on Israel. To those who were truly penitent, to those who saw the error of their way and who wanted to change things and truly turn back to the living God, God held back on his wrath from utterly destroying them. But he tells why he did become wroth, why he did do this. He says, "For the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth." That is his greed. It was the iniquity brought about by the greed of the people of Judea that God was wroth. And this is why he smote him. That is why he smote Judah, the nation of Judah. And in one place in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul talks about covetousness, which is idolatry. It seems that covetousness is very closely associated with idolatry. The wanting to have something, the wanting to obtain something. And this is the chief thing that he names among the people at this in this very phrase. For the iniquity of his covetousness, that is the sin or the evil that was brought about by his greed, that's why I was wroth, and that's why I smote him. And he goes on and he says in verse 17, I hid me and was wroth, and he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. I hid me means that God withdrew his presence. He left from being in the presence of Judah when he was sinning so. And that same thing happens to us. When we are so hard-hearted and we decide we want to turn to some other source for solace, to some other God for comfort, to some other God for guidance rather than the true and living God, God just withdraws from his presence from us. He'll hide himself. And we won't have to worry about God because he's not there. He's not going to keep standing around for you to trot him down. He'll take his word away from you. He'll take away that even which you have. And that's what he did here. He said, I hid me and was wroth. And he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. That is, these people worshiping the idols just went on even more into idolatry because God had actually withdrawn from the scene. He'd hid himself. Verse 18, I have seen his ways and will heal him. Now, I think this has a reference to the fact that he is, he's seen those who were penitent, those who really were sorry for what they'd done, those who were ashamed of those groves and those green trees. I have seen his ways and will heal him. When he's seen our sorrow, when he's seen our contrite heart, when he's seen our repentance, then he will heal. He will heal us. I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. Now the mourners would be those that were sorry for sin. God said, I'll lead him. I'll restore the comforts and his mourners. Now this figure is intended to depict literally while they were in captivity at Babylon, when the time came when God had seen enough repentance, he'd seen enough mourning, then he decided he would heal and he would lead and he would restore the comforts. And this is all depicted by him leading them out of the captivity, having somebody to prepare the way so that he dug down the hills, filled in the valleys, straightened out the crooked ways, smoothed out the rough ways, and he led them then from their captivity in Babylon back to the land of Judea, to Jerusalem, and to the temple, or to rebuild the temple. Now that same figure is given today in the Christian age, in which when somebody is in the captivity of Babylon today, that is in sin, in the grasp of Satan, whenever this person has repented enough and is sorry for his deeds enough, and he has God to see this, and God will heal him, then again, God leads him. And just as John the Baptist came and prepared the way for Jesus, and that's a figure of what Isaiah said about preparing the way when they left Babylon, even so today, we have the way prepared for us. We have a way in which we can truly be made to follow after God. I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. Verse 19, I create the fruit of the lips. Now the fruit of the lips are those things that come forth from the lips, and this has to be talking about thanksgiving. And so the blessings that God gave to his people caused them to give thanksgiving. And it's worded like this then, that he creates the fruit of the lips. That is, the blessing that he gives causes them to give thanks, or causes them to give thanksgiving. And it's really then him, God, that's creating the fruit of the lips. Further in verse 19, peace to him that is far off, and to him that is near, saith the Lord, I will heal him. Now, this phrase of peace is talking about all of the comforts, all of the benefits, and the joys, and the blessings that come with salvation. It's summed up in the word peace. Peace with ourselves, peace with those round about us, and greatest of all, peace with our God. We know that we're saved. We know that we're going to be taken care of. And we're just like back in verse 2 when he's talking about those righteous that were put to death. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his righteousness, in his uprightness. So here again, this is the way we are. We have this peace. Peace to him that is far off. And in Ephesians 2:17, Paul talks to him that's far off, about him that is far off and him that is near. And that is reference to the Gentile and to the Jew. And so I think this same reference is intended here. Peace to him that is far off, that is those that know not God. If they'll just become contrite and become humble and turn to God, then God will lead them and get this peace. And to him that is near. Him that is near would be the one that is either a Jew at that time, or one that has already turned to God, but maybe he has backslid some way, and he's still lukewarm but close to God and needs to come on and do some more repenting. He has that peace offered to him also. He says, and I will heal him. And the healing here has definite reference to the healing of the sickness that comes as a result of sins. Now in verse 20, he's still talking about the fact that those who would trust to God and turn to God, he's going to give them consolation. But in verse 20, he starts talking about the wicked. What's going to happen to those who do not turn, to those who choose to remain wicked? But the wicked, he says, are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose water casts up mire and dirt. Now, as we think about the sea, and in particular the troubled sea, we have there something that cannot rest. It is continually in a state of motion. And particularly the troubled sea, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. Now, just think of the fact of how unhappy you would be to be in a state like that, where you're continually in a state of turmoil. You cannot rest. You cannot settle down. You cannot be peaceful. But it's a continual turmoil, a continual trouble. You cannot rest. And all the turning and all the churning that goes on just simply turns up mire and dirt. You don't have any goodness. You don't have any righteousness. You don't have any of the things that really go with God's people. All you have is mire and dirt. And he says that's the way the wicked are. They're like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. In verse 21, really says it all about the wicked. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. No peace to the wicked. You do not have peace with yourself. You do not have peace with those with whom you have to do, that is your neighbor, your fellow man. And worst of all, you do not have peace with God. You're at enmity with God. And as we think of what he said a little bit earlier, that if he contended with man too long, and if he didn't back off, then the spirit should fail before me. That's what he says. And that's what's going to happen to the wicked. Eventually, the wicked's spirit's going to fail before God. He's contending with the wrong one when he contends with God. He cannot win. God is his creator. God is the one who should be worshipped. God is the one to whom all honor and homage should be paid. God is the one that we should be afraid of, that is, have a fear and a reverence and a respect for. There is no peace saith my God, to the wicked. And so with that statement, we conclude our study of Isaiah chapter 57.